readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we've got a literary and loving salute to dads. There's comedy, some touching true life titles, even a nonfiction tale well done for the king of the grill. And yes, moms, there's lots to love in this show, including an interview with a Hollywood icon whose new book shares her journey, along with her husband, to becoming parents instantly. So kids, time to give your folks some much-deserved time off as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. After being dumped by his longtime girlfriend, 28-year-old Justin Halpern found himself living at home with his 73-year-old dad. Sam Halpern, who is like Socrates but angrier and with worse hair, has never minced words. When Justin moved back home, he began to record all the ridiculous things his dad said to him, and thus we have the book, Bleep, My Dad Says. More than a million people now follow Mr. Halpern's philosophical musings on Twitter. If you're one of them, or even if you're not, you'll get quite a kick from this all-American portrait of the father-son relationship that unfolds on the Little League field, in Denny's, during excruciating family road trips, and most frequently in the kitchen over bowls of grape nuts. Sean Schemmel performs the book.
After my first night back home, I crawled out of bed at around 8:30 a.m. and set up my office, read my laptop, in the living room where my dad was watching TV, to begin writing my first column. Michael Jackson had just died, and I was working on a comic portraying Jesus overlooking the pedophile charges against Michael Jackson and letting him into heaven anyway because he was such a fan of the King of Pop. My editor later pointed out that it should have been St. Peter ushering MJ through the gates of heaven, but that's beside the point. My dad had a hard time understanding that someone sitting in his pajamas and searching through Google Images for silly pictures of Jesus Christ was working, so he treated me like I wasn't. Every so often throughout the rest of the day, my dad would get fired up about something, bound into the living room from the kitchen or front yard or wherever he'd been, and shout something like, "Are you putting ketchup on that hamburger I made you?" "Yeah, why?" "Why?" It was good to be home. For as long as I've known him, my father has been a blunt individual. When I was little, I mostly felt terrified of him, so I couldn't appreciate that I was dealing with the least passive-aggressive human being on the planet. Now, as an adult, all day long I dealt with people, friends, coworkers, relatives, who never really said what they were thinking. The more time I spent with my dad in those first couple months back home, the more grateful I started to feel for the mixture of honesty and insanity that characterized his comments and personality. I took that quote and posted it as my instant messenger away status that evening, and every day after that, I take one funny remark my dad said and use it to update my status. When one of my friends suggested I create a Twitter page to keep a record of all the crazy things that come out of his mouth, I started, "My dad says." For about a week, I had only a handful of followers, a couple of friends who knew my dad and thought he was a character. Then one day, I woke up to find that 1,000 people were following me. The next day, 10,000, then 50,000, then 100, 200, 300,000. And suddenly, a picture of my dad's face and his quotes were popping up everywhere. Literary agents were calling, wanting to represent me. TV producers were inviting me onto their shows, and reporters were asking for interviews. My first thought was, this is not good. The emotion that followed can only be described as sheer panic. To illustrate how my father hates any kind of public attention, let me share his opinion of contestants who compete on Jeopardy. My dad's a well-read, educated guy, and one evening when I was watching Jeopardy, he strolled into the living room and correctly answered every question Alex Trebek posed. "Dad, you should totally go on Jeopardy," I said.
"Are you kidding me? Look at those people. They have no respect for themselves, no dignity. Going on a reality show like that, it sickens me."
I knew I had to tell my dad that I had been posting his quotes and quips online and now had publishers and TV studios interested in adaptations of the material. But before I did, I figured I'd call my oldest brother Dan with the hope that he would tell me I was blowing the situation out of proportion and that our dad would be fine with it.
"Holy, you did what?" Dan said to me in between giant belly laughs.
"Dude, Dad is going to... I don't even know what Dad's going to do. You'd better be prepared to leave his house. Like, if I were you, I'd pack up my stuff beforehand, fugitive style. Only important belongings that can be carried with one arm."
I decided to take a walk around the block and gather my thoughts before I confronted my father. A walk around the block turned into a few miles around the block, and as I was finally heading back toward the house an hour later, I spotted him sitting on our front porch looking like he was in a good mood.
We've just heard Bleep, My Dad Says by Justin Halpern. So, Dad likes to grill, does he? The book report has quite the tale for him. When Daniel Duane became a father, the San Francisco surfer and climber found himself trapped at home with no clue on how to contribute. Inept at many domestic tasks and less than eager to change diapers, he took on dinner duty. Up to this point, his culinary high point had been pasta. But he had a biographical anomaly. Chef Alice Waters had been his preschool teacher. So he cracked one of her cookbooks and cooked his way through it. And so it went with all seven of her other cookbooks, then on to those with other famous chefs, amounting to an epic 8-year cooking journey, chronicled in How to Cook Like a Man, a memoir of cookbook obsession. Butchering whole lambs at home, even hunting pigs in Maui, Duane so thoroughly immersed himself in the modern food world that he met and cooked with a striking number of his heroes. Among other adventures, he wrote a cookbook with Alice Waters and had private lessons from the chef he admires most, Thomas Keller. The memoir is performed by James Patrick Cronin.
Bringing that first baby home from the hospital and settling into our new lives, Liz and I faced a nightly decision. One of us had to wrangle the newborn and change the dirty diapers, and one of us had to make dinner. Like a lot of guys in my predicament, two-income family, wife working hard, I chose dinner and, without realizing it, new territory. My own father couldn't fry a burger, and Mom made nearly every home-cooked meal he ever ate, aligning my parents with 97.8% of the 185 human cultures studied by the first anthropologists to look into such matters. At least according to Richard Wrangham's Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. Wrangham admits that human males are perfectly capable of cooking, as evidenced by professional chefs, and also by husbands helping out in urban marriages. But he offers these exceptions to prove the rule, pointing out that even on tropical Venatnia, a natural feminist paradise where both sexes hunted, fished, and fought wars, islanders still considered cooking a low-prestige activity meant for women alone, right down there with cleaning up pig droppings. Wrangham places the source for this ancient division of labor, and marriage itself, deep in our evolutionary past, at about the time we discovered fire. The very project of cooking food, by this line of reasoning, called for a primitive protection racket, whereby females did all the cooking and males rewarded them by making sure other men didn't steal the results. For me to become the family cook, in other words, buy all the groceries, read all the cookbooks, meant taking on a role without a script. But it didn't feel optional. My father had worked long days at his law practice, so he'd never suffered even the slightest compunction to look busy in the evenings. And he'd never needed the domestic camouflage of the putatively productive but secretly calming chore. I had a wife working right alongside me, doing the same kind of journalism out of the same home office, but also doing the house cleaning and waking up 5 times a night to nurse the baby. And I had a conscience offering up the obvious thought balloon. Maybe I'll deal with my obvious inadequacy by taking full responsibility for seeing to it that our little family has a delicious, wholesome meal on the table every single night, forever and ever. Not least because Liz won't have the energy to make such a meal for at least a couple of years. So far, so good.
That was How to Cook Like a Man by Daniel Duane. Neha Vardalos is the Academy Award-nominated actress and writer of the blockbuster hit My Big Fat Greek Wedding. An alumnus of the Second City Comedy Theater, some of her other film critics are Connie and Carla and My Life in Ruins. Neha also co-wrote Larry Crown with Tom Hanks. Nia's new book, Instant Mom, chronicles the bumpy road to parenting she and her husband, actor Ian Gomez, traveled. Friend and colleague, the comedian Rachel Dratch, summed the book up brilliantly. Instant Mom is not just for anyone considering adoption, and not just for anyone who ever thought of becoming a parent. It's for anyone whose big life plan doesn't follow the path they thought it would, and shows us that unexpected obstacles can lead to beautiful rewards. Welcome, Neha. It's a pleasure to have you join us on the book report.
Well, thank you so much. I'm just getting used to this new title of author.
All right. I have to say, Instant Mom, I read it in one afternoon, and it feels like you're sitting in the room talking to me.
Oh, that's the ultimate compliment. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You.
In the book, you describe yourself as a middle child Canadian who's basically annoyingly nice and wants to see everyone happy. So I'm a youngest child Pittsburgher. Same description, though, so it's nice to meet a kindred spirit.
Yeah, I am happiest on my movie sets when everyone has a drink and a snack and everyone's waiting and the director says action and I go, yay, let's act.
It took you 10 years to become a mom, yet you named your book Instant Mom. How come?
It's an ironic twist in that my daughter was almost 3 years old when we met. And so, and also, yeah, we met 9 months after I had begun working with American Foster Care. So we went through the process. We had a home study fingerprints. And then one night, the phone rang, and I heard about a little girl, almost 3 years old, who had been legally emancipated, living in a loving foster home. And as my husband and I drove to meet her, I cannot explain to you why I knew that this was it. I knew it. This was going to work. And as we got, she was in a parking lot with a lot of social workers, a lot of people standing around her, and she was in a social worker's arms, a little brown-haired, almost three-year-old little girl. And as we walked toward her, of all the people in the parking lot, this little girl turned around and looked right at me. And all I thought was, oh, I found you. And that was it. From that time on, I became her mom. I was her mom, an instant mom, just like that, of an almost three-year-old little girl. And as you know, the book, Instant Mom, is pretty honest about all the things that it took me to become a mom. And then, because I don't want to sugarcoat adoption, I'm pretty honest about how it was to transition an almost three-year-old little girl into our home. It was not easy, and I'm laughing now because my daughter's 8, and all these stories are funny to all of us now, but at the time, all I cared about was trying to help this child feel safe, and she was pretty mad.
Yeah, and also you had quite a bit of sleep deprivation in the early days.
Yes, it was challenging and yet rewarding because she punched, she kicked, she screamed, she was angry, she was terrified. We were two giant adults. She didn't understand why she was with us, and also she was afraid, of course, that we would leave. And so we had therapists come in, we went to a sleep therapist, we had so much help with these social workers. They were just on the phone all the time and I could confide in them. And then we learned through a really great sleep therapist what to do, and I know it sounds absolutely insane that we did it now, but we did it. We put a cot in her room and slept on the cot. No matter what time she went to bed, we stayed in the room. So so that when she woke up in these, and I'm not exaggerating, 2-minute increments, I was there.
Yes.
And then the 2 minutes slowly turned into 20 minutes, and I was there. And we got her to trust us by showing her no matter what, when she went to sleep, either myself or my husband would be in that cot. And within 6 months, she was sleeping 10 hours a night.
Yeah, well, congratulations. During the process of adopting, you admit that the social worker's visits to your for your home study was more stressful than meeting the Queen of England. Share that story.
Well, I weave in what I call my shameless name-dropping Hollywood stories. My producers of my first movie are Rita Wilson and Tom Hanks, and Tom's partner, Gary Getzman. Well, I tell that story. I tell how I met them. They came to my one-woman show and read my screenplay of My Big Fat Greek Wedding and then let me star in it. I also had dinner with the Queen of England. So I thought, I'm never going to write an autobiography. I'm never going to write about my daughter again. But wait a minute. I think I can weave them all together. So I tell the story of when the social workers were coming over. I'm not a grown-up. My husband is also an actor. The two of us are extremely immature people, and somehow we've gotten through having dinner with the Queen of England. We were invited when she was on her Jubilee tour through Canada, and yet meeting the social workers who would deem or not deem us responsible enough to be parents made us sweat more.
I believe it. I have two children, and one is adopted. I've done the home visit thing, and I baked brownies just so the house would smell good.
That's great. Yeah, you read in the book. I made up words. I was so anxious to let her think that I was some sort of, TV mom, that I said things like, yes, I like to cook and home make.
Right. I wanted to ask you kind of a more serious question. As you know and wrote about so poignantly in your book, once you're a mom, it doesn't matter how the child came to you. Your love is absolute. As an advocate for adoption and foster care, how difficult has it been for you to get this message across?
Well, it's difficult because, as I say, I don't want to sugarcoat it. And, of course, there are children living in American foster care who are going to need a very patient and tolerant parent to take them in. But because I've met those parents, I've met the people that take in special needs kids and kids from abusive and neglectful backgrounds, and then seen the kids go on to lead productive and wholly splendid lives, I thought, well, I have to write about this. I have to find a way to counterbalance the media's seeming need to just tell us the scary stories by just telling about the stories that I've seen. But as I say in the book, yes, there are some kids that live in terrible situations, and I just wanted to talk about them all, because there might be a person out there who goes, hey, my kids are in college. I'm going to take in that kid.
Yeah. At the end of the book, you include a how to adopt appendix. For someone who may be considering foster adoption, what's an average wait time, and describe the process?
The process is the same for adopting via American foster care or domestically, or bringing a child from an international adoption into your home. You have to have a home study. You have to have a background check and fingerprinting. And then it gets different, which is why the 25 pages of how to adopt from all over the world are what it's the book I was looking for. I couldn't figure out what was the difference between a foster family agency and a foster agency. I just couldn't figure it out. So that's why I describe all the ways to adopt. What I suggest is, actually, I'm not really calling myself an adoption advocate anymore. Having been on the book tour, I realize what's resonating with people from the book is that it's not an adoption book. Women are seeing it as a feminist guide to happiness. And I realize, I've got to go back and find a different way to describe it. It is my autobiography on being a fearless idiot. It led me to a career in getting to be a working actor and writer, and it also led me to the happiness of being a mom. But that's not for everybody. And that's why I'm realizing that these 20-year-olds who are reading my book and trying to break into screenwriting, that makes me happy too.
Yeah. All right. I have an extremely important question for you. Are you teaching your daughter about the miracle of Windex?
My daughter has never seen My Big Fat Greek Wedding. That was, of course, our choice first. My husband and I decided not to show her films and TV shows to try and help her identify family members as who they are, because my real family is in my Big Fat Greek Wedding and all my movies. My cousins and aunts, uncles, everyone shows up to be background actors. So we felt it would confuse her to see my Big Fat Greek Wedding with, and seeing my husband actually plays John Corbett's best friend. That would be confusing. So she's never seen it. She doesn't know the Windex joke. But, of course, my dad does walk around with a bottle of Windex saying, Windex is a cure for everything.
That is now in the American, lexicon of terms. So what are you working on now?
I'm writing a movie for Paramount. It's an anti-romantic comedy. Romantic comedy. I asked them if I could write a movie making fun of all my other movies. And they said, sure. So I'm producing it with two other fantastic producers, and I'm playing one of the roles. It's an ensemble movie. A bunch of people throw an all-night party.
All right.
My husband and I have decided we are donating the proceeds of the book Instant Mom to children's charities all over the world. We noticed the one thing over and over again when we meet these charities and we meet these people in these orphanages, they need money. They need money for mental health for these kids. They need money to get the information out. They need money to help parents come to their country and adopt. So if you're listening to this interview and saying, well, what can I do? You can buy the book and the money will go to help kids get a home.
And I want to say, readers, you should buy the book because it's so much fun and it's so warm and wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Instant Mom.
It's 8 a.m. in early 2003, and I am driving through a rare and raging rainstorm in Los Angeles. My hands are shaking. I don't want to have a horrible accident on the freeway that an infamous ex-football player once made famous. It's a cliche, so of course utterly true, that L.A. people don't drive well. I'm not talking about me. I'm from Winnipeg. I took my driving test the day after a snowstorm. I'm tough. However, nothing prepared me for early morning Los Angeles morons driving and reading a script they forgot to tell the intern to cover, plus sexting a mistress whilst sipping a gluten-free, soy-free, GMO-free, not at all free, power shake. Therefore, a rainstorm is a particularly foolish time for me to be on the freeway. Hard rain pounds my windshield. Wind whines against the car windows. My palms ache from how hard I am gripping the steering wheel, and my eyes blur from trying to focus. I am trembling, but it's not the storm that's making me anxious. I've just been nominated for an Academy Award. The shock of this is making my teeth clang. It's been close to a year since my Big Fat Greek Wedding opened, and it's still playing in theaters. So many nominations, from a Golden Globe for acting and Best Comedy Film to a People's Choice Award, are hard to comprehend and absorb. And now this has happened. The impossible. I had written a script in an attempt to get an acting job, and this morning I'd been nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. But I didn't celebrate with champagne. A gaggle of friends didn't rush over to jump up and down with my husband and me, then devour a lavish brunch. Sure, I'd been woken up before dawn when the phone rang with the amazing news from my best friend, Kathy Greenwood. That led to an exciting round of call waiting from family and friends, lots of noise, excitement. Then my husband and I looked at each other and somberly accepted the reality of what I had to do that day. He went to work and I got in the car. Now I am alone, driving to the fertility clinic for my early morning lab work in yet another attempt to be a mother. I am on IVF number 3. For many years, I have been hiding a dumb secret. Not being able to carry a baby to term has made me deeply unhappy. While I am grateful for the success of the movie, it just doesn't matter. Sure, I'm thrilled, but all I can think about this morning is how long I have been trying to carry a child to term. Over the past 5 years at least, I'd often been pregnant. There is no feeling of disappointment I have ever known like a miscarriage. So I am now in awful, painful, and time-consuming fertility treatments, and even working with a wonderful and selfless surrogate. I don't know if this will work, but I do know I will keep trying. Because I am obtusely obstinate. I am the type of person to whom the word no is a shortened version of try a different way. I just never accept the word no. The fact that I'm a working actress and writer is simply because I am incredibly stubborn. Over the last years, many, many people told me no, as in, get lost, fatty. They would look me right in the eye and say no, but I just heard, go around me, fatty. It's ironic, bordering on tragic, that I share common traits with psychopaths and serial killers in that we're focused and truly believe we're right. I have no idea how I got this way. I am the second daughter born to two fantastic and funny parents. I was raised in Winnipeg, an excellent Canadian city of pleasant and cultured people. I have two wonderful sisters and a delightful brother. We're very close and yet all quite different. I was always a bookworm and loved performing, so I decided to be an actress, even though my parents wanted me to be a dental hygienist, or better yet, marry a dentist. Yes, a Greek one. I did community theater and many musicals in Winnipeg. Then I auditioned for professional classical theater schools across Canada and got into all of them because I was so beautiful and talented. Actually, no. No, I wasn't. I got rejected by every single school. I was an overweight and overconfident hairy girl with a very loud voice. Nobody knew what to do with me, but I was a boisterously exuberant person living a good life in Winnipeg. I took university classes, did more community musicals, dramatic theater, some large professional productions, and made a good living working as a florist.
We've just heard Instant Mom by Nia Vardalos. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. When he became a dad, Michael Lewis, popular author of Liar's Poker and Boomerang, found himself expected to feel things he didn't feel and to do things he just didn't see the point of doing. At first, this made him feel guilty until he realized that other fathers were in the same boat. Michael decided to keep a written record of what actually happened immediately after the birth of each of his three children. Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood, is that record. But it's also something else, a wonderfully funny, unsparing account of daily household life recorded from the guy's point of view. Dan John Miller narrates.
Why should even fictional representations of different parenting styles be an invitation to argue about who should do what? One answer. In these putatively private matters, people constantly reference public standards. They can live with their own parenting mistakes so long as everyone else is making the same ones. They don't care if they're getting a raw deal so long as everyone else is getting the same deal. But there are no standards, and it's possible there never again will be. We're all just groping, then lying about it afterward. As a result, the primary relationships in American family life have acquired the flavor of a Moroccan souk. I began keeping a journal of my experience of fatherhood 7 months after the birth of our first child. The listener will quickly see that I didn't set out to write about new fatherhood. I set out to write about Paris, but Paris was overshadowed by a seven-month-old baby. Most of what follows was written in the hazy, sleepless, and generally unpleasant first year after the birth of each of my three children. Most of it was also written within a few days after the incident reported. I found pretty quickly that any thoughts or feelings or even dramatic episodes I didn't get down on paper immediately, I forgot entirely, which was the first reason I began to write stuff down. Memory loss is the key to human reproduction. If you remembered what new parenthood was actually like, you wouldn't go around lying to people about how wonderful it is, and you certainly wouldn't ever do it twice. Which brings me to the main reason I kept writing things down, this persistent and disturbing gap between what I was meant to feel and what I actually felt. Expected to feel overcome with joy. It's a boy! You must be so happy! I often felt puzzled. I shouldn't be just as happy if it was a girl. Expected to feel outraged, I often felt secretly pleased. Expected to feel worried, I often felt indifferent. That's just a little blood. For a while, I went around feeling a tiny bit guilty all the time. But then I realized that all around me, fathers were pretending to do one thing and feel one way, when in fact, they were doing and feeling all sorts of things, and then engaging afterward in what amounted to an extended cover-up. As this book is largely a collection of stories, I'll use one that didn't make it in to illustrate the point. Cut to the journal. We're at a fancy hotel in Bermuda. Like fancy hotels everywhere, the place is paying new attention to the whims of small children. The baby pool is vast, nearly as big as the pool for the grown-ups, to which it is connected by a slender canal. In the middle of the baby pool is a hot tub, just for little kids. My two daughters, now ages 6 and 3, leap from the hot tub into the baby pool and back again. The pleasure they take in this could not be more innocent or pure. Then, out of nowhere, come 4 older boys, 10, maybe 11 years old.
We've just heard Home Game by Michael Lewis. The book report brings you this title for several reasons. 1, Dad probably loves thrillers. 2, central to this mystery is a man who is a father and a grandfather. And 3, I'm going to Iceland this summer and I want to immerse myself in the country's culture. The only author to win the Glass Key Award for Best Nordic Crime Novel 2 years in a row, Arnaldur Indridason has sold more than 5 million copies of his novels in 25 countries. In Arctic Chill, a detective whose inner turmoil threatens to consume him is charged with investigating the death of an Asian boy. To do so, he must confront forces colder than Iceland's frigid climate. George Guidel narrates.
The garden behind the flats did not seem well kept. In the middle was a patch of gravel that served as a little playground. There were 2 swings, one broken so that the seat hung down to ground level and spun around in the wind. A battered slide that had originally been painted red but was now patchy and rusty, and a simple seesaw with 2 little seats made from bits of wood, one end frozen solid to the ground and the other standing up in the air like the barrel of a large gun. "We need to find his boat," Sigurður Óli said. They all looked at the sock with the hole in it. "This can't be happening," Elling Pork sighed. Detectives were searching for footprints in the garden, but darkness was falling and they couldn't see much on the frozen ground. The garden was covered with a coat of slippery ice, occasional clusters of grass poking through it. The district medical officer had confirmed the death and was standing where he thought he would be sheltered from the gale, trying to light a cigarette. He was uncertain about the time of death. Somewhere in the past hour, he thought. He had explained that the forensic pathologist would calculate the exact time of death by correlating the degrees of frost with the body temperature. On first impression, the doctor could not identify a cause of death. "Possibly a fall," he said, looking up at the gloomy block. The body had not been disturbed. The pathologist was on his way. If possible, he preferred to visit the crime scene and examine the surroundings with the police. Elintur was concerned at the ever-growing crowd gathering at the corner of the block, who could see the body lit up by the flashing cameras. Cars cruised slowly past, their passengers absorbing the scene. A small floodlight was being erected to enable a closer examination of the site. Elintur told a policeman to cordon off the area. From the garden, none of the doors appeared to open out onto a balcony from which the boy might have fallen. The windows were all shut. This was a large block of flats, by Icelandic standards, 6 stories high with 4 stairwells. It was in a poor state of repair. The iron railings round the balconies were rusty, the paint was faded, and in some places it had flaked off the concrete. 2 sitting room windows with a single large crack in each were visible from where Elintur stood. No one had bothered to replace them. "Do you suppose it's racially motivated?" Sigurður Óli said, looking down at the boy's body. "I don't think we should jump to conclusions," Erlintur said. "Could he have been climbing up the wall?" Ellingpork asked, as she too looked up at the apartment block. "Kids do the unlikeliest things," Chico Deroli remarked. "We need to establish whether he might have been climbing up between the balconies," Erlintur said. "Where do you think he's from?" Chico Deroli wondered. "He looks Asian to me," Ellingpork said. "Could be Thai, Filipino, Vietnamese, Korean, Japanese, Chinese," Chico Deroli reeled off. "Shouldn't we say he's an Icelander until we find out otherwise?" Erlintur said. They stood in silence in the cold, watching the drifting snow pile up around the boy. Erlintur looked at the curious bystanders at the corner where the police cars were parked. Then he took off his coat and draped it over the body. "Is it safe doing that?" Ellingpork asked with a glance in the direction of the forensics team. According to procedure, they were not even supposed to stand over the body until forensics had granted permission. "I don't know," Ellingpork said. "Not very professional," Chico Deroli said. "Has no one reported the boy missing?" Ellingpork asked, ignoring his remark. "No inquiries about a lost boy of this age?" "I checked that on the way here," Ellingpork said. "The police haven't been notified of any." Ellingpork glanced down at his coat. He was cold. "Where's the person who found him?" "We've got him in one of the stairwells," Chico Deroli said. "He waited for us, called from his mobile. Every kid carries a mobile phone these days. He said he'd taken a shortcut through the garden on his way home from school and stumbled across the body." "I'll talk to him," Ellingpork said. "You check whether they can find the boy's tracks through the garden. If he was bleeding, he might have left a trail. Maybe he didn't fall."
That was Arctic Chill by Arnoldur Indridason. Father's Day, A Journey into the Mind and Heart of My Extraordinary Son, is a remarkable memoir from the best-selling author of Friday Night Lights. Buzz Bissinger's twins were born 3 minutes and a world apart. Jerry, the older one, is a grad student at Penn. His brother Zach has spent his life attending special schools. He'll never drive a car or live by himself. He is a savant, challenged by serious intellectual deficits, but also blessed with rare talents, an astonishing memory, a dazzling knack for navigation, and a reflexive honesty that can make him both socially awkward and surprisingly wise. One summer night, Buzz and Zach hit the road to revisit places they'd lived during Zach's 24 years. Zach revels in his memories, and Buzz hopes this journey into their shared past will bring them closer. During the trip, Buzz, who narrates, gains new wisdom and realizes that Zach's character transcends his intellect.
He leans back in the lazy boy I once gave him for his birthday and often watches the 10 o'clock news on Fox. Not because he wants to keep up on current events, but because he takes comfort in seeing the usual television newsmakers like the mayor and the police chief and the indicted city official. He also liked learning the names of the anchors and the weatherman. The world by its nature is chaotic and unpredictable, but Zach always narrows it down to a reliably straight line. Because of trace brain damage at birth, his comprehension skills at the age of 24 are roughly those of an 8 or 9-year-old, although he is quite verbal. He can read, but he doesn't understand many of the sentences. He has basic math skills, although he is still prone to using his fingers. He understands money to a certain degree. Because his mother Deborah and I encourage independence, he is allowed to use public transportation to go to Philadelphia, where his other job is, stocking supplies at a law firm, and where his brother lives. The train stops at 8th and Market. He is supposed to walk the rest of the way if it is daylight, about 7 blocks. But sometimes he sneaks in a cab ride. The fare is $10. He dutifully pays the meter, but then he leaves a $5 tip, making him a favorite among Philadelphia cab drivers who otherwise drive in silent misery. He can't add 100 plus 100, although he does know the result is a lot. Which is close enough when you think about it. He goes to movies, but the action and plot don't filter down to him. He seizes on images that he has seen before. I took him to see Spartacus once when he was 8, and after a blood-flowing scene at a Roman villa, where Kirk Douglas single-handedly kills 2 million buffed-up soldiers with a plastic knife. He turned to me and said, "Look, Dad, a pool." He has always loved pools. In his early teens, he belonged to a swim club that competed against other clubs. He swam the 50-yard freestyle. He finished far behind the other contestants. But it didn't matter. He still finished, every stroke like swimming against a frothing high tide. To this day, I don't know how he did it. It is the most monumental athletic feat I have ever seen. His IQ, which has been measured far too many times, is about 70, with verbal scores in the normal range of 90, but with performance skills of about 50. I love my son deeply, but I do not feel I know him, nor do I think I ever will. His mind is not simple. It's limited to a degree that profoundly frustrates me, but it's also inexplicably wondrous at certain moments. I have dedicated my life trying to fathom its inner workings. I can make educated guesses, some of which I think are accurate. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but I've spent nearly a quarter century trying to pinpoint the best learning and life strategies for Zach. So I am far more confident of my conclusions about him than theirs. Some of them so haphazard, they might as well have been made during the 14th hole on Maui before the convention luau. It is strange to love someone so much who is still so fundamentally mysterious to you after all these years. Strange is a lousy word, meaning nothing. It's the most terrible pain of my life. As much as I try to engage Zach, figure out how to make the flower germinate because there is a seed, I also run. I run out of guilt. I run because he was robbed, and I feel I was robbed. I run because of my shame.
That was Father's Day by Buzz Bissinger. At the high point of a soaring career in the U.S. Army, Lieutenant Colonel Mark Weber was tapped by General David Petraeus to serve as a military advisor within the Afghan parliament. Within weeks, a routine physical revealed the 38-year-old father of three to have stage 4 intestinal cancer. Over the next 2 years, Weber would fight a desperate battle he wasn't trained for, and one he would not survive. Mark began to write a letter to his boys so that as they grew up without him, they would know what his story had taught him about courage and fear, challenge and comfort, words and actions, pride and humility. This book, Tell My Sons, written with David Murray, is that letter. And it's not just for his sons. It's for anyone seeking advice on how to live an ordinary life in an extraordinary way. The author narrates.
Dear Matthew, Joshua, and Noah, I wrote a book for you. I started writing it long before any of you were born, and even before I met your mom. But it was always written for you. When I was 12 years old, my Grandma Weber died of a sudden heart attack. As we helped Grandpa go through her things, we came across a letter he wrote to her in August 1944. His work kept them separated, and he was writing to tell her about his job, the weather, no mention of the world war raging across the sea, and how it seems like it has been a year here without you. He was playful. He drew several doodles in the margins, one of which was a man sticking out his tongue. He closed the note by telling her how much he enjoyed the roast and the cake she made for him, and then he drew two birds, one for each of his sons at the time. The faded letter looked and felt like an ancient treasure, but what impressed me most was that I had never heard Grandpa talk or act that sweet. He didn't even remember writing it, and said it didn't sound like him at all. That bugged me. I wanted to know more about Grandma, and I sure wouldn't want to forget what it was like to write a letter like that. As I grew older, I found that all my grandparents were short on details. Of course they had stories, but not always the details I wanted to know about. They couldn't remember young emotions or reasoning, and they wouldn't talk about their biggest mistakes or regrets. The questions I had didn't match the answers they were willing or able to give. I imagined someday I would have grandkids. Yes, grandkids. Who might be just as interested in me as I was in my grandparents. And so I started writing a journal, and I kept it brutally honest. Looking back, there's a lot of stuff I'm really not proud of, but I figure maybe those ugly things reflect my growth through the years. This book comes from that journal. Of course, I imagined one day sharing these stories in person, but now I'm dying, and I realize I might not even get to share it with you boys, let alone with any grandkids. If attitude alone determined survival, I would live another 50 years. Unfortunately, our bodies get a vote, and my 40-year-old frame is giving out way sooner than it should. Despite some breathtaking treatments, I still have cancer, I can't have any more surgeries, and the chemo is failing. I may look invincible in my army uniform or while cutting down trees with a feeding machine strapped over my shoulder, but to suggest that I'm not dying is just dishonest. So I started thinking about ways to tell you my stories. There's an 18-year-old boy inside of me who sees the three of you quickly approaching the age when I started really thinking about life. That boy stood out on a parade field 23 years ago as a day four enlisted soldier in the Army and listened while an unseen narrator passionately recited an adaptation of General Douglas MacArthur's famous 1962 speech to the cadets of West Point. The words and the accompanying music pulled at the hair on my arms and neck, and I felt tears roll down my cheeks. For the first time, and forever after, I understood life was much bigger than the things that were happening around me. I committed the speech to memory and have recited it with the same passion during countless retirement ceremonies and military holidays over the past 20 years. You three were all just babies when the Army recognized me as one of the best company-grade officers of the 30,000-plus in the Army. The honor? The General MacArthur Leadership Award. The truth is, I'm not a big fan of Douglas MacArthur and never have been. I attended a military high school and have been in an Army uniform since age 14, so I knew who MacArthur was when I first heard his words. He always seemed more movie character than actual man. And it struck me then that if you want to be a real-life man, you have to learn from real-life men. But his speech to those young men is about being a real man. It's about life as struggle and our need to embrace it. About the contradictions and complexity and confusion, about the courage and search for wisdom required to get through it all, and about coming to it all as honestly as a man can reasonably do.
That was Tell My Sons by Lieutenant Colonel Mark M. Weber. Michael Chabon offers an autobiographical narrative as powerful as his Pulitzer Prize-winning fiction. Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son are insightful, provocative, interlinked essays that present Chabon's autobiography through a series of reflections, regrets, and reexaminations. As a devoted son, a passionate husband, and above all, as a father, Chabon, who performs the book, offers memories of childhood through adulthood, at once humorous, poignant, and memorable.
I hit the space bar, stopping the music, and observed a moment of silence for my own lossy life, and thought about a man whom I had not seen in almost 30 years. My mother's ex-boyfriend took me to buy my first stereo system, her present to me for graduating with the Howard High School class of 1980. He was studying electrical engineering at the University of Maryland. His name was Bill Warriner, and I loved him. Bill was quite a bit younger than my mother, who was herself not yet 38 that spring. He wore his lank, sandy hair long, and he took me seriously in precisely the same measure as he found me amusing. He was a wide-eyed, soft-spoken Midwestern guy who had been in the army and played in local dance bands back in his hometown. I seem to recall that he was a drummer, and I remember his telling me that the only time he ever stepped to the microphone during a gig was when the lights went down and it was time to sing If by Bread, with its line about all the stars going out one by one, and how that would not necessarily be such a bad thing in the right company. I never hear that song without picturing it being sung by Bill Warriner. He was the first adult I ever knew who felt and knew how to express, if only through the passion of his talk about changes in band personnel and hidden meanings in song lyrics and unexpected chord progressions, the central truth I was then only just beginning to grasp, that my life was compounded out of discrete particles of time, and that those moments were built, in turn, out of the matter of rock and roll. Bill accepted his commission from my mother with characteristic gravity and aplomb. He drove me down to an audio equipment store in Laurel, Maryland, half an hour away, that catered to men who knew how to be grave about their audio equipment. It was a no-frills kind of place, tangled cables and metal shelving and a smell of ashtray, harshly lit except for the radiant, dark luxury of its banks of tuners, amps, and speakers. I stood quietly to one side, a candidate for some kind of experimental surgery, while my fate as a listener was determined by Dr. Warriner and his team of consultants. Like the planet Alderaan, a record, it was Boston's debut album, as I recall, was selected to serve as a demonstration of the destructive capability of various audio death stars. I pretended solemnly to be able to distinguish among their highs, lows, and middles, when in fact all I heard when listening to them was might, a kind of amplitude that seemed to emerge not from the speakers or the shining grooves of the record, but from the mind or thews or rumbling belly of God himself. "I like that one," I said, repeatedly. I came home with a Yamaha tuner amplifier, a Technics direct drive turntable, and a pair of modestly sized Genesis speakers, and Bill helped me set everything up in my bedroom, with the turntable and tuner right beside my bed, and the speakers at two corners of the room. It was a business not merely of decor, but of engineering, of pliers and wire cutters and heavy strands of cable on spools. Then it was time to put something on. At this point, my collection consisted of a number of 45 RPM records, many of them painfully embarrassing: Convoy, The Streak, Grand Funk's cover of The Locomotion, and the complete works to date of Queen. The bulk of the records that I regularly listened to on the old family Duel were part of the family's collection: Dylan, The Beatles, Godspell, There Goes Ryman Simon. Or they were things I checked out of the public library, discs of passage. I had a feeling that Bohemian Rhapsody would probably be an amazing experience on my new system, but as with all the records I liked, the house copy of A Night at the Opera was ill-used, scratched and dusty, incriminated with the prints of my adolescent fingers.
That was Manhood for Amateurs by Michael Chabon. In Dad is Fat, comedian Jim Gaffigan, best known for his literary riffs on Hot Pockets, bacon, manatees, and McDonald's, expresses all the joys and horrors of life with five young children. Everything from toddlers' colorful communication skills to the trademark eating habits of four-year-olds. Performed by Gaffigan, the book is sharply observed, wonderfully funny, and a cry for help from a man who's realized he and his wife are outnumbered in their own home.
I often wonder what my children really think of me. I can be silly and playful, but at times I do have to be a bad, mean daddy. For example, I rarely give them one more chance. If they are not getting dessert, they are not getting dessert. I have actually turned the car around. I try not to be mean, just strict. And they let me know, from the moment my children learned to speak, I've heard many different versions of, "You are a bad, mean daddy," in reaction to my strict style. Just when I start to worry about being remembered as a tyrannical figure, my children remind me in their unique style of communication that I am not, in their eyes, the dictator that I think I am. Negotiation seems to be the predominant form of communication in my daily dealing with my children. Dad, if I take a bath, can I watch a movie? What do I get if I clear the table? I always seem to be on the losing end of arbitration. I constantly feel like I'm bartering with my children. I suppose this is part of the parent-child dynamic. I'm sure that throughout the centuries, sons and daughters have bartered with their fathers and mothers. I wonder if Jesus negotiated with God about some of the stuff he had to go through. Jesus, you are dying on the cross for all mankind. Well, if I do that, can everyone have Sundays off? Notice the response is always a question. The question is the primary form of communication for little kids. They learn to speak and the questions commence. Anyone with kids knows about the questions. Daddy, what are you doing? Daddy, why are you doing that? Daddy, how long are you going to be doing that? Daddy, why are you putting on headphones and having a beer for breakfast? I sometimes believe preschool was created by a parent who needed a reprieve from the incessant questions of a three-year-old. Of course, these never-ending questions require answers you are not qualified to give. How do you answer, Daddy, why are you a stand-up chameleon? Or, why don't dogs get the chicken pops? When my son Jack was 4, he pointed to a car antenna and said, Look, Daddy, stick. I clarified, Actually, that's an antenna. Jack then asked, What's an antenna? After realizing I had no idea how an antenna worked, I explained, It's a stick, a metal stick. You nailed it, buddy. Even all their so-called statements will contain a question in the subtext. I'm hungry is really, why don't you feed me? I have to go to the bathroom is, can you clean up this pee on the floor? Another endless form of questioning is under the are we there yet category. If you ever mention something fun that you are going to do with your young children, and there is any time that will elapse between the very moment you bring it up and when you are actually doing the fun thing, you will be barraged with questions during the entire time period. If you tell them that you might go to Disney at some point in the coming year, you have opened a Pandora's box. Are we going to Disney now? How long till we go to Disney? Is it time to go to Disney yet? How many hours till Disney? What does 3 months mean? Is it 3 months yet? It is crucial that you withhold as much information as you can about this fun future event until 30 seconds before you arrive, or 10 seconds, depending on your question tolerance. Out of necessity, all parents of little kids actively attempt to curb the unnecessary question by speaking in a parental code to each other. Parents will write notes, whisper, or spell things in front of their children. Once Jeannie said, Don't tell anyone about the ICECREAM. I remember thinking, who's in the emergency room and why do I want a dilly bar? Of course, there are many things you shouldn't say or do in front of a three-year-old. Everyone knows you're not supposed to argue or curse in front of young children. What you'll learn is the only time a parent really needs to argue or curse is when they are with young children. If you don't believe me, wait until your kid spills a drink on your computer. We tried a cursing mug where if Jeannie or I cursed, we'd have to put money in the mug. 2 hours later, our son threw a ball and accidentally broke the mug. And yes, I cursed when he broke it. Even more important than not arguing or cursing, a parent should never say the words ice cream in front of young children. Little kids only hear a commitment. Yeah, I'll have ice cream. You can't explain to them, Daddy's just saying the words ice cream. It doesn't mean we are going to have it right now. Do you understand? They will, of course, nod and say, I'll have chocolate.
Well, we've just heard Dad is Fat by Jim Gaffigan. Happy Father's Day to our heroes, the guys who shell out the cash, share the car keys, and offer the love and support we needed to thrive. Special note to procrastinators, and you know who you are. If you still haven't found that perfect gift for Dad, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for titles he'll truly enjoy. Thanks so much for joining me today, and let's meet again next week on the Book Report.